Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. Out of the Frame acknowledges the people of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation, on whose unceded lands we record each episode from. We respectfully acknowledge ancestors and elders, past and present. It was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. My guest today is Isabella Capezio, who is a photographer and artist living and working on stolen Wurundjeri country. Isabella's artwork and research connect themes of failure, power, and queerness with landscape. Isabella has organised and facilitated various photo book workshops and displays at home and in the Asia Pacific. They recently completed a PhD in media and communications, experimenting with alternative ways to reflect on place, vision, nature, and colonial frameworks of power. Thanks so much for coming, Isabella.
Thanks for having me.
I thought we'd just get started by hearing about how you got interested in photography and where your journey started.
I grew up on Ngunnawal country in Canberra, and it was a very sheltered and safe environment. And my mum is a cook, and so she had lots of recipe books that she would always claim were tax deductible. And I would pore over those books, and I got really interested in the photography that was being used in them. And then my godmother had a dark room because she was a photographer, and the dark room underneath the house connected to the garage was always this clean and very mystical space that I was really interested in. And she would kind of let me go in and turn on the lights, and her photos were around their house. So I was really engaged in photography from a young age. And then when I went to high school, I did media, and they had a dark room at high school. And that meant that I got to experiment with the practice of actually making images and augmenting them and how many possibilities there were. And once I got over the overwhelm of all the possibilities, I think I realized that having perhaps a hands-on and experimental practice could really situate my work as my work, as opposed to following other traditions too closely, I think.
Do you think having that background as a young kid and knowing that, you know, you could have a dark room at home also gave you that kind of vantage point of going, you could make it your own way rather than going, I have to follow those footsteps or that style?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested in trying to break things from the start and turn them in a way on their head. And I think when you realize how, I guess, ad hoc something could be. I mean, honestly, Irene's darkroom, my godmother, her darkroom was quite amazing for what it was. I would love to have one. But I guess I just saw how convenient and how convenient something that could make and create, like how convenient a space could be, and it could create so much from that space. And I also would recognize, I would spend a lot of time in the dark room at high school. And I would recognize how many changes can be brought about, and how those changes, if it's more time, more exposure, layering, cutting, collaging, how those things can really affect the overall interpretation or like what you're trying to say with the images itself.
I think that's really interesting because there is something like that material process, that experimental process, like the magic of the darkroom. Like I remember it from high school too. And it feels like another time. Like it is you kind of situate yourself in something that is separate from outside. And so that idea of kind of the agency and the play of changing things and shaping things, and as you say, the possibility is so, I think, really formative in the idea of image making and how you can capture the world, maybe?
It's really, the darkroom is like a womb or something. Like you're really isolated from the outside world. And that means that time disappears. So you can spend a long time in there, in like a flow state, sometimes a frustrated state, sometimes depending on the level of light that you actually have in the space. Yeah, it really tests you a lot. And I like that challenge. I'm definitely not a purist in any means, but I've realized that I've clocked up a lot of time spent in the dark room, in different dark rooms in my life, making them, realizing that that was probably an unsafe environment to be in, you know, making them yourself, having a fan and thinking that that's the same as an extraction fan, which it's not.
All the things you learn.
Yeah, the things that you learn, and the people as well who teach you are really, well, the people that taught me, the various people that taught me were really influential in facing those challenges. Rather than maybe negotiating a style, they were really inspirational and influential in how to continue a practice, I think, and just to show up.
Life skills rather than,
I think so.
So from there, high school, what made you keep going with photos?
I studied media and communications, but in Canberra, I still didn't really know what I was going to do. I took many gap years and I went traveling a lot. And I think I used photography through that time. It wasn't until I realized that I wanted something more creative in media and communications, because it was a focus with advertising and graphic design where I was. I realized that I was more interested in the ideas and creating something. And so I took life drawing and I took photography as an elective. And one of my lecturers in photography, he was talking about this archaeology project that he was on. And I remember being in the lecture theater thinking, why is this guy talking so much about getting up early and no shadows? And, you know, it just felt so specific that it felt strange for an introductory to photography. But I was also still, I could see how much he was interested and invested in this. And I tell this story because it turns out that he actually was in the same dig house as I ended up in almost 10 or 12 years later. By coincidence.
Wow.
And so I thought, wow, Bob Miller, you had a lot to share with me, and I wish I'd tapped into that resource earlier. But this elective, you know, it was quite basic, and they had some rudimentary studios that I used, and I took some portraits of a partner at the time, and one of my classmates, he commented that they were really good. And, you know, we all love a bit of acknowledgement, I guess, of our talents. And so I was kind of compelled to continue then. I've since developed why I'm interested in photography in a much more interesting way that hopefully we'll get to. But my dad, he was pressuring me to decide what I would like to do after I finish university. And I said at the dinner table, because he's a bit of a disagreeable person, you have to have your argument ready, right?
Yeah.
To go into the fight. So he was like, what are you going to do next year? Are you going to get a job? And people in my university course at the time were saying that they had to like go and pitch themselves to these advertising companies. And I just couldn't think of anything worse than that. So I said to my dad, I'm going to go and study photography. And he was like, where? And I said, Melbourne.
And then, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Cool. And you studied?
I studied at RMIT. Yeah. I moved down to Melbourne, studied at RMIT. And I was a mature age student at that point. So that was such a gift. I'd already been a young adult and a 20-year-old in uni, confused and scared. So the second round, I was asking lots of questions. I wasn't ashamed that I didn't understand everything. I was helping my fellow students. I was teaching them things. And that's how we can really hone our craft, is by helping others. If we're repeating and trying to explain what we understand and how we understand it, that really can cement cement some knowledge. So I became like this pseudo teacher straddling the student and teacher kind of realm. And I think that I haven't stopped doing that since.
I was going to say, and you're here now as a lecturer in photography, very much engaged in your own practice and teaching students and helping students, which is very cool.
Yeah, some of my students say that sometimes they roll their eyes because my classes are a bit, they're half photography, half politics and half therapy sessions. So I'm always giving out this.
Great. I can't wait to like advice. Like see you in maybe 30 years or something. Be like, don't you like all the students be like, did you have Isabella as a teacher? Like it'll be great. I think that legacy is fantastic. I also think what you said about being young and going to university and having those really formative experiences is part of the job as a lecturer. That's pastoral care as much as it is inspiration, practical knowledge and actual skills and supporting ideas. So I don't mind if there's a bit of therapy in a class, I think.
You know? I think that I am trying to teach people how to be photographers, but that's not my priority, I guess. I'm trying to teach critical thinking. I'm trying to teach confidence.
Totally. How to be in the world.
Yeah, how to be a person in the world and how to be open to, I guess, the world itself, open to different ideas and different ways of exploring how they want to communicate their ideas. So I think having been a student helps me to reflect on what kind of a teacher I want to be. Yeah.
Amazing. I thought we might talk about some of the work that you have done in terms of photo books, the Asia Pacific Photo Book Archive. How did you get into doing that? And I know you do teach an incredible photo book subject as well.
Yes, a lot of that is thanks to Daniel Boker-Smith, who was my teacher, a lecturer when I was in second or third year. And I really admired his understanding of conceptual photography and contemporary photography. And he was obsessed with photo books. And I guess I spent a lot of time in the library here as a student. And so I really liked books and, you know, I was looking at cookbooks from a very young age. And so I was really interested in the printed form, especially because, again, the layers of practice and the layers of materiality that affect an outcome and affect a message. So I was really interested in photo books. I made many photo books in second and third year. Everything became a photo book for me or a zine. And so I guess I was just naturally really interested in all the ways that all the books that could be different and how design and materials can really help support a message. So after I finished, and before I did my honors, I took a year off and I thought to myself, well, I don't really want a real job yet. I want to be able to make work and I want to, my priorities are develop my film, eat and live somewhere. They were my number one.
I should ask also, do you cook?
Yes. I'm a great cook.
Excellent. I feel like I'm compelled I'm compelled to ask that question with all the cookbook references.
Yeah, in another life I have my own channel, but not.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Or maybe later.
Later in life. Look out, Nigella. I thought to myself, okay, these are the things that I need. How can I get them? And I actually volunteered a lot of my time and I was being supported by the government. So I figured that, you know, if I'm getting Centrelink, I could give my time elsewhere. And what would that actually give back to me? As much as I love the idea of selfless volunteering, I think it is also good to trade things. So I interned at a lab that was doing black and white processing and I learned how to do a lot of film processing that way. I did that a couple of days a week. I volunteered at Lentils as Anything as a cook so that I could eat there and take food home. Yes. And I also volunteered at the Asia Pacific Photo Book Archive. So those three things those three areas like kind of sustained me and supported the things that I thought I needed. And I was able then to go to Cambodia. I went to Cambodia for Angkor Photo Festival with the archive one of those years. And I realized that that photography and festivals and events are a great way to make really good, strong connections with people because you have something in common. And so you have a talking point or an interest already. So I went there and, yeah, I made lots of friends, some of whom I still am friends with and keep in contact with. And it was through kind of putting myself out there. I mean, I was in a privileged enough position to be gaining Centrelink. And I think I might have had a, you know, paid job on the side somewhere in between that. So I can see that I worked hard, but I also had a lot of privileges that let me take those risks and make those opportunities work for me.
What is it about photo books that you love so much? Beyond what you described as a material kind of process, photo books scare me. I love them, but the idea of making them just really, I get quite anxious.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Morgana recently and McGee, who's part of Tall Poppy Press, and she loves the form because she feels it's really freeing and is not as comfortable exhibiting, where I'm like, I'll put a show on every other year because I love the speciality of it, where I find there's something that this, maybe it's commitment or something with books that I don't want to screw up. I don't want to screw up the sequencing or the paper choice, and you only kind of get one go at it or something. What is it for you about where it's a zine or a really beautiful art book, handmade edition art book or the standard photo book, that you think just is the thing that draws you?
I think it's the variation that's interesting to me. It's the process itself. It's that because I was making books for myself, I wasn't engaging with publishers, or there wasn't also the amount of small publishers that exist now when I first started 12 years ago.
Yeah, so it's very recent.
Yeah. So, and I think that what the Asia Pacific Photo Book Archive did, and the reason that we're not as active anymore, is because we have fulfilled our quest.
Oh my God, totally.
In a way,
I think
to highlight the importance of photo books as a medium, as a communicating tool, within and also to highlight and amplify stories in the Asia Pacific. So I think we did that by engaging with lots of people, going to festivals, workshops, and also having a space where we don't sell anything. When we had a physical space and I would be there invigilating on Saturdays, it was nice. People would walk in and, they got to spend time, not money. And some people would walk in and be like, there's nothing to buy here. Okay, bye.
They didn't get it.
They didn't want to engage in something that they couldn't have. But back to your question, I think that the photo book for me is, I don't have to ask permission from someone else. I'm not looking for permission to show my work. I don't need to apply for anything, right? I can just do what I want to do.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
And I can make the thing. Sometimes I only make one or two. Sometimes I make 50. Sometimes they don't sell. Sometimes I give them away. And so for me, it's there's no EOI, there's no peer review. I literally can make a book out of anything. There's the books that you can make in one day that I make in workshops with participants. There's books that take years. And so I think that engaging in that space, and also there's lots of platforms for sharing those books. There's lots of photo book fairs. There's lots of photo book fairs adjacent to festivals now. And so I just see it as a really great way to put your work out there. You can also usually have more pitches than, you can have more pitches than you would if you're making work to an exhibition space. They still are spatial, I would argue.
Okay.
Perhaps not in the same nuanced way of exhibitions and installations, which I'm interested in as well, but there's always room to have books in a space, in an exhibition as well. And I think that they can just be so many different things that, to me, they tell a longer story they request attention and you can be in someone's lap.
Yeah, I do love that. And look, I love a photo book. I own many photo books and have admired many photo books. And
I think
there's an intimacy with a photo book that you don't necessarily get in an exhibition. And, yeah, and you can return over and over and over again. And, yeah, there is a beauty in that and an elegance in that, I think, and also an idea of legacy. And you can give it. I love the idea of giving away photo books and or passing on photo books. I've been gifted many. And I've always found that like an extra special gift, I think. We've talked about process quite a bit and environments. Could we talk about what you actually like photographing?
Yeah. Yes. Well, the funny thing is I don't know how much photography with a capital P I do.
Okay. Why? Explain that.
Because I find it, I guess I have a lot of conflicting feelings and ideas around photography. That's one of the reasons that I like it so much. It's so paradoxical. It's so problematic in lots of ways. It's fun to try and excavate what that could mean for different people, I guess. So as much as I love, you know, a documentary style expanded photography, like that's the kind of photography I'm drawn to, I think that the things that I want to take photos of are like places that I want to be in a lot of the time. Like a huge reason why I don't perhaps do maybe commercial work is because I don't actually want to be spending my time in those spaces.
Mm-hmm. You have done a little bit though.
I have done a bit and I would do it again. You know, if the client was something that was adventurous and exciting and, you know, easy to collaborate with, then I'm more than interested in expanding and challenging myself in all ways possible. But I mostly just want to be outside. I realize more and more. I just want to spend most of my time outside. So I guess, you know, landscape photography comes into that. I'm really interested in pushing myself more with portraiture because I have a lot of overthink a lot of the relational parts about portraiture that I would like to try and undo. I'd like to be less critical and analyze less just generally.
And respond more.
But also I think I go through phases of photographing my everyday life and I remember that how important it is for the future me that I take photos of my life now. And I also have realized by looking at pictures, you know, of the past that we are always hotter than we think. So I'm always thinking.
What a great comment.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at pictures of yourself 5-10 years ago and you think, wow, so hot. Why wasn't I?
Why didn't I feel it?
Yeah. Why didn't I feel it? And I mean, this is not just me. I'm thinking generally as well, like psychologically, maybe we think that. And so I want to try and give that as a gift to people as well, you know, to be thinking about the future of that person, the future of how they feel about it, not just the uncomfort perhaps of the moment.
Which it can very much be in a portrait.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really lovely thing to say. I also feel like we could be kinder on ourselves in the moment too, in just every aspect of our lives. You know, it's, yeah, we're still hot, we look great, whatever version of it you want to say, but also we're switched on, we are engaged, we are doing the things that we want to be, we are kind. Like, let's just be okay. Mm. Yeah, sometimes.
Let's be okay out there.
Yeah. But going back to the idea of landscape, mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, you know, being in a dig out, like,
oh yeah, being an archaeologist.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
how,
sure.
How,
yes,
dirt, maybe.
It's a great question. I love rocks. I've always loved rocks so much. Rocks for me, that I don't know, there's something really special about them. And in another world, another life when I'm not doing my cooking show, I would also be a geologist. But a lot of geologists get caught up in mining, so I would feel my values would be conflicted even more so than they are today.
That makes sense, yeah.
Using still extractive technologies, which photography is, but.
So how do you photograph or engage with rocks?
In my personal life?
Yeah, in your photography practice.
All right. I mean, I just love it.
I'm sure you have a rock collection.
I did have a rock collection. I did. Yeah, there's something about rocks that I really like. They speak to, you know, they speak to composition. They speak to time. They speak to place. So I've always been interested and engaged in rocks. The reason that I got into archaeology was by chance. Again, I'm really open to taking opportunities when they come. And I was, you know, I was like asking the universe, like, I need something. I want something. And I saw this email that was sent to the photography school at Media and Comms. And they were asking, someone from La Trobe asking if there were any photographers who had any experience in this kind of field and were willing to travel. And I did something that I've never done before, but my brother has done, and he taught me the cold call. And I don't think a lot of people.
Gotta love a cold call.
Especially not cis men. Like, cis men love a cold call and feel confident with that. Myself, not so confident, but I tried out the cold call and it worked to my advantage.
You just have to practice. You just have to do it. I've worked out if you start on like really small things and then build up, then it's fine. And actually, they're really worth it.
Yeah.
People engage with the cold call.
I think in response to, you know, emails and different ways of where all the different ways that we communicate now, maybe the call is so personal. Hearing someone's voice is so personal.
Yeah.
So that worked to my advantage. Cold called. I spoke to the director of the dig. I said, I am your person. I would like to come. You know, I voiced a desire to come. And he asked a few questions and he said, yeah, I think that you'd be a great fit because you've been, you know, I had spent years traveling. I think he was worried about the culture shock more than anything. Like, he wasn't too worried about my skills. And it turned out that my skills were challenged because the studio was so makeshift. But luckily, I was used to this kind of makeshift energy.
Can I ask what you actually photographed?
Yeah, sure. So as my job, as part of being on the dig, this was a specific dig in Pella, in Wadi Hama, and it's in the just right near the Jordan River in Jordan. They were digging. I didn't dig. They'd found a site. It was an early Natufian site for anyone who's interested out there. But it's roughly, I think it was like 14,000 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's what they like to call, which I don't like, prehistory. Which just means like before writing.
Before.
Which I disagree with.
Yeah.
Anyway, there was a lot of communication going on. And there was lots of trade and beautiful objects that were made. And everything that is dug out of the ground cannot be kept, as in like Australia, like because I went with an Australian team through La Trobe University. And so they work in relationship with the Department of Antiquities in Jordan. And so everything that is found underneath the ground is then owned by the government. So everything needs to be documented before it is gone into storage.
Essentially. Okay.
Yep, so I documented everything from tiny, I can't remember their names, but tiny shells and beads made out of out of bird bones. Mm-hmm. I made some fish hooks. And then skulls.
Wow.
Yeah. So then, it was like tools, like basalt tools.
Yeah.
Then it was adornments. Mm-hmm. So, and just everyday items that were being crafted and traded. And then over 4 years, they because I went a few times, a few years. And so then they got down to a burial area. And so then it was like bones and skulls, that kind of thing.
Wow. Yeah. What an extraordinary experience.
It's wild to be touching things that are so, so old and have remained kind of so latent in a way that, that have like, been underground. But the everyday is, you know, when we say archaeology, a lot of people have a very romantic idea about what archaeology is. A lot of people wanted to be archaeologists when they were young. I personally didn't, but I really enjoy being around people who are interested and curious about the things that they are interested and curious about. And I've learned a lot about history because I never studied history. So I learned a lot about history through this process and documenting all the tiny bits of, you know, objects and ephemera that come out of the ground.
I think also it's quite apt thinking just about archaeology and colonialism and how we excavate, extract out of sites and how very much photography comes within that line and continues to, even moving into AI and new technologies. Do you want to just maybe set the scene about your PhD, your topic?
In a nutshell, my question was based on a problem that I see, and the problem is that I guess the value of land is very subjective to the pictures and the visions that we see of land. And as someone living on stolen land, and I guess reconciling with that, or maybe not reconciling, maybe the better word is like coming to a deeper understanding of what that means through experience and time, then how do we take photos of that landscape in ways that unsettle a colonial space that is Australia? And
that's not a small question.
No, not a question I answered.
I attempted
and I made some provocations in ways that I thought that I could problematize the schema of the schema of this issue, this colonial, I guess the colonial project that was facilitated and supported through photography, because we use photography, early settlers use photography, you know, to capture things, to categorize, to narrativize it, to label things, to, create divisions in a landscape that wasn't theirs to begin with. So thinking about how could we use the technology and still use photography, but in a way that then creates more questions, problematizes the ways of looking that we're so used to. So thinking about landscape photography, like mainstream landscape photography and the practices associated with that, I was thinking about ways that you could betray, pervert, fail, and like ultimately unsettle that, because then we could gesture towards the facts, which are that we are all living on unceded stolen land, and there's no way to photograph ourselves out of that. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense.
Because when we're photographing something, we're creating a distance. Even though when we're looking at pictures, we think we're closer to the thing, the photograph itself actually disconnects us from an embodied experience of landscape. Or nature, if you want to call it that. There's lots of issues around the concept categorization, the conflation of nature and its gendered associations, and that dualistic system further interrupts our connections to a landscape that is stolen and that we profit off, but one that we are still responsible for in lots of ways.
Yeah. And in one way you did that through what you sort of said as queering methodologies. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. I guess queering methodologies is like thinking about a subjective position, a subject position. For me, it's being a queer person, but thinking about how, and not taking this lightly, not just saying I'm a queer person so I can take pictures of outside and call it queer.
Sure. Yeah.
But also moving outside of thinking about queerness, it's often attached, especially through photography, to the body,
mm-hmm.
through portraiture,
mm.
right? Through domestic spaces,
yep.
through the idea of private spaces. And so I was really thinking about how we all extend past our bodies. Like we all have affect and we all create ripples in the world and we all consume. And so if we're consuming the things that we're consuming, right, we are then putting in the bin that then goes somewhere else. Like we are literally, yeah. you know,
we have an imprint.
Yeah, we have an imprint. Yeah. We extend past our bodies. And so I think that just having this idea that, you know, you're responsible for your body and it ends at the skin. And I really wanted to try and think about queerness as well as like going beyond the skin and being part of the way that, I guess, like that's where Sarah Ahmed's phenomenology comes in, because it really thinks about how the subjective perception and experiences cannot be ignored and needs to be acknowledged when we are thinking about interactions, when we're thinking about how we see and formulate an understanding of the world around us. It all comes through the body. And but on the same, or maybe, yeah, on the same level, I guess, thinking about then as well expanding this idea of queerness past the body and into space. So queerness can be this twisting off course to that, what to in reaction to, or maybe not even in reaction to, just it just is a different way of being in the world. And that needs a space to, you need a space, right, for the body to be in. So could queerness extend past the body? Yes. Could it be spatial? Perhaps, because a body is always in relation to the spaces that it's in. And so to think about then a queer body engaging in landscape is perhaps not that different to anyone engaging in the landscape. However, thinking more about queerness as a verb, so it's like something that is done.
Mm-hmm.
And so the body also formulates through repetition and through doing, and those lines are formed by doing, and then the lines are formed by being followed in a way. And so trying to twist off course is a really nice way to recognize that a queering can happen through seeing patterns and recognizing that you're not, perhaps you have diverged as a subject, right? Your subject position diverges somehow from that, and being excited by that rather than needing to reconform to a certain path is part of the queer experience. Doing something differently is part of the queer experience for me anyway.
Thank
I have
you.
A queer manifesto that I could also read out maybe at the God. End.
Maybe at the end. Let's do that. I love that text and I use that text a lot. And I guess I relate at it not from being queer but from the cultural identity position, and her work on queer phenomenology is similar, like recognizing the positions that we hold, noting that they're different and that there's purpose behind them and agency, but also a becoming and a authenticity, I think, of looking at that relational space. Because I think it's fascinating to kind of understand through the body within space and then how you encounter either other bodies or other spaces and their imprints, how you then negotiate them. And, you know, she talks brilliantly about those things and then further into institutions as well. Mm. But I note also that your work, you have inserted yourself into your images for in the landscape.
Yeah.
And in really unusual, I'm going to use the word performative ways, but that may not be the intention.
No, it definitely is, because, I mean, if you think about how gender is performed, everything is constructed and performed. So, yes, I definitely performed in them in wacky ways.
And with costume.
With costumes as well. Yeah. So I guess as part of the the provocation to pervert something. I was really thinking about, yeah, my PhD took a journey. It was a real eight-year journey. And I didn't make any photos, which is bizarre. And that's what I mean by I'm thinking about the photographic, but I'm not necessarily then just repeating photography with a capital P, if you will. So, or maybe you could call it street photography, even though that's the kind of photography I admired when I was studying, which is interesting. But so, yeah, I was really trying to, as I was also mentioning, like, you know, after I left school, I was like interested in photography and this kind of particular style of photography. And I thought to myself, how can I make it mine? How can I really assert myself? And I thought about, oh, I need to intervene and somehow I need to intervene in the spaces. And that was like sculpturally, I would make sculptures and photograph them, but how do I intervene? And I thought about, yeah, using my body. And I didn't want to, but it's based on a great queer theorist, Jose Esteban Munoz's idea of disidentification, where I was thinking about what would my reaction be to being in front of the camera if I was no longer identified as Isabella Capezio? And how could I, thinking about the gaze and vision, and if I can't see that I'm being looked at, how do I perform differently? And if I can't be identified as a self, how does my body, mind, in a way, does it care that I'm being photographed or being filmed? And it's so interesting because I could, yeah, because by not being a self, which is like part of ego, I guess.
Well, not being Isabella Capezio, you mean? Yeah. Like yourself.
The self. But yeah, with all the conceptions. All the of,
yeah, 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 I understand.
The ego and the shame and all of those things. If they're taken away,
yeah,
I can do it. And so I was really thinking about how we project into these other spaces beyond our bodies to look at ourselves. And that takes a lot of energy. And there's a lot of critique in that because of the spaciousness in a way. Like you have to really project far to see yourself and then you're not really feeling, you know, nothing's coming from a place of feeling. So I was really thinking about what happens if I'm moving away from a place of seeing to a place of feeling. And that that is antithetical in a lot of ways to photography because it's all about seeing. So yeah. I really wanted to test out how that felt and it was cold.
It was cold.
It was cold up there in that mountain being naked. But I also woke up one day and I just thought to myself, I'm going to cover myself in photo paper and expose myself to the landscape. And
I think it's so fantastic.
Let the landscape expose itself onto me. And it just felt so absurd. And I'd been working with like lumen prints before and different ways of, you know, creating sculpture. And I thought to myself, well, I could be the sculpture. But the other... That video runs in a loop alongside another video that was taken. They weren't meant to be together, but they're taken on two sides of a mountain range. And so in that one, there is a figure who is in a ghillie suit, which is like a military sniper costume, I guess. And yeah, that character kind of comes to life in this different kind of plant-based way. But I was really thinking about, yeah, perverting the masculine hero, the war masculine hero, and perverting these kinds of, perverting the photographer as well by becoming the camera in the one where I cover myself, and then perverting this, like, perverting the masculinist, like, war, yeah, military hero through kind of queering the ghillie suited body.
Mm. Yeah. Other than being cold.
Yeah, I shouldn't just make it about me.
But I think it's interesting.
My feelings.
Well, no, because I actually think that makes it real, right? Because we don't get that from the videos.
Yeah.
If you bring it back to like skin, you know, I'm being slightly, you know. But I think the thing that I find interesting about the act of it and also that you decided to do it, like, again, I mean, I'm obsessed with self-portraiture, but I think there's something really interesting about that. But I'm guessing, was that a particular choice of putting yourself out?
One of them isn't me.
Oh, great. There you go. I didn't know.
One of them is my beautiful friend.
Okay.
Who I collab-
oh, there you go. That's
my lifelong
really great.
Friend. Yes.
They didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, no one really does. I mean, not because I'm trying to hide it, but I guess
Well, yeah, you can't hide it now. Unless you want me to edit it.
No, I don't I don't think I need you to no. What happened was like yeah, I didn't want it to be about self-portraiture. Again, it's not about the self.
Yeah, so this is what I was trying to work out because it felt like a bit of a conundrum. If it's you're trying to move beyond self, which you actually do because what you're saying is that you gave into feeling rather than kind of, I guess, thinking and perceiving. Like, and then, but then by putting yourself into the landscape, you are doing that thing, but then you, but then it's you. Does that make, like, that's where I find it is always
I guess
an interesting
like
thing.
The weird idea is mine. And so it very much is me in the same way that all pictures speak to the person that made them.
Totally.
More than they probably would like.
Totally.
So I also think that sometimes I don't have all the answers to why I'm making work and I won't.
Any of us do. Yeah.
And I thought this is either going to be really good or really bad and I'm still not sure. It's still somewhere in between those things.
You're just
which
too
I'm
close to the
with.
PhD.
Yeah.
You're a bit like that thing you said earlier that you were hot. It's good work.
Okay, just as a disclosure, I didn't think I was hot, but I'm saying generally
no, I meant,
speaking.
That's what I mean though. Yeah. Like, you know, that thing. You will look back and go, oh, that was good work.
Right. Some distance is great.
Distance is amazing,
for
actually.
That.
I felt the same thing.
But I wonder if distance is time rather than space.
Yes, I agree.
And
in this instance, I think that's what you need. You need time away from the thing to actually digest what you have done and recognize its value and worth, both through process and the outcomes.
Yeah, and that comes back to phenomenology as well because Merleau-Ponty, thank you. Merleau-Maurice Ponty, who was the kind of godfather of phenomenology after Husserl, but he and Sarah Ahmed and Liz Gross really take from Ponty, Merleau-Ponty, sorry. And he was thinking about this optimal distance where, especially in perception, where the thing that we're looking at reveals itself through this optimal distance, but distance can also be, it can be a space and it can also be time. So maybe it is that when we're,
I love phenomenal.
Yeah. When we're like looking back at something that we've made, we have enough distance from that because of time that we can, that it can reveal something to us at different points in our life, you know, which is why it's really good to have a praxis where you are engaging in research, engaging in practice, and you're also reflecting. And that itself, to me, is a spiral anyway. Like it keeps spiraling and it kind of is never ending. And it should be never ending in the colonial project as well. Yeah.
Totally. I think actually what's really lovely is that thinking about that and that phenomenological kind of approach is how very much so much of your practice. Praxis actually does. Like you are constantly coming back and rethinking and re-engaging and putting yourself in or out or back in and out of the landscape or within the space.
As well, like I'm also using, as we were saying before, when you're using materials, when you're making books and you're creating installation, you're affecting that work that you thought was finished time and time again. So, again, there's that revisiting of things.
Yeah, and so, then video too, right?
Yeah, and so even though I started, you know, I made lots of projects for my PhD, that was kind of the idea, was to cycle through different different ideas quite fast, but I would always come back to them. So okay. Nothing really was finished until the last 2 years, which
was
interesting.
Was that an enjoyable might not be the right word. I guess was it like fruitful?
Yeah.
To do it in that way? Because that's not what a lot of people do.
No, but nothing is finished for me.
Okay.
Things just run out of time. So
is that just you in general?
Yeah, that's me in general. So yeah. I would take the most amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. that is needed, and then I might need an extension. But I will always always be thinking about how I could have done things a little bit different. And if given the chance, I will make changes all the time to my work.
Yeah, which is also a really lovely metaphor of like nature, right?
Mm.
Like nature is cyclic and constantly transforming and changing and doing its thing. So it's kind of lovely that you have that too. I wanted to circle back to the darkroom mm-hmm. and whether or not any of those material processes were part of the PhD in a way that, because I know you did a residency at Photo Access mm-hmm. for the dark matter residency. Is that work related or is it kind of tangential?
Great question. I wanted to put it into the PhD and they said no. But to be honest, it would have been hard to connect in the same way. Yeah. But I loved that residency because it was long. It was a year long. It meant my family loved that residency because it meant I was going to Canberra all the time.
They got to see you.
They got to see me a lot. But that residency was actually really useful for me because I learned and taught myself how to make colored pictures. So I thought I'm just going to be black and white in the dark room. I thought I'd run out of time to learn it. And then this residency came up and I thought, I'm going to try. One of the ways that I decide what I want to do for a project is decide what I want to learn and what skills I want to gain. And so I was like, I'm going to try and teach myself how to do color printing. And I had to do it by hand using a tube in pitch black dark.
Oh my gosh,
and I created, I created an amazing system and I spent hours.
Yeah, I could only imagine.
I think I clocked like at least 50 to 100 hours in the dark room and I'd be there at various very strange hours because that way there's less interruption because you can't even have a red light on when you're doing color stuff.
Yeah. Wow.
And
that space is very cool.
I had
a show there a few years ago.
It's great. And yeah, it's haunted, but we could talk about that another time, but in a good way it was haunted.
So
anyway, I'll get back to it. The idea for that work was to respond to Ian North's Canberra Suite, a selection of pictures that he made in the 80s about Canberra. And growing up in Canberra, I never saw any pictures that resonated with me, that were interesting because it's the nation's bush capital and because everything is just based on landmarks and this idea of what we want to people on the outside to think Canberra is. So when I saw these pictures, I was really taken aback and really resonated with me. And I started recognizing places. And I was really intrigued by how I could tell where these pictures were taken, even though they don't have landmarks, they don't have signs. And so I actually engaged my whole family who have all lived in Canberra for a very long time and a lot of them are in construction, so they do a lot of driving around. Mm. And I would engage them in this game that I called, where is this photo? Where was this photo taken? And we would all gather around and I'd be like, what about this one? And my dad would be like, the bricks of 1960s and we need to go to these places over here.
Wow.
So everyone had, and they're like, that's Mount Taylor in the background, but it looks different now because it was drought season then. And we just had
that knowledge.
Yeah, that weird.
Right? That like
embedded
deep,
knowledge yes. of place yes. was really interesting to me. And I really wanted to engage more with that. So while I was out taking pictures of spaces that I was interested in Canberra that had the same kind of feeling, you know, I was guided by where Ian North was taking his photos, but I didn't want it to be, and I found some of the exact places, but I didn't want it to be like a spot replica. The difference then and now kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about how I could still have some pictures that do show the changes in Canberra, but how do I also make this my own work? And so I engage people in interviews where I would ask them, people who had lived in Canberra since the 80s, I interviewed them, asked them about what they remembered, what their experience was. And then together we looked at Ian North's pictures and I kind of recorded them looking at these images, trying to identify where they were.
Okay.
And so adjacent to my work, which is just a selection of the pictures that I think that I printed myself in the color, using the color process. Adjacent to that is this like an edited record, like the interviews, the audio interviews. And I interviewed like, you know, my nonno who was in construction, who was building houses, right, since the 60s. My cousin, like a curator. I really wanted to expand it a bit further, but some of my connections, like I wanted a landscape architect and a city planner. But, you know, there's still the potential for it to expand more if I wanted it to. So anyway, I got maybe 8 people and I interviewed them. Especially thinking about real estate, actually, I had a real estate agent, someone who was a removalist, just like some random people who were kind of commenting on how Canberra's changed.
Yeah.
And then they're also talking to pictures that aren't actually visible, which I really like because that then challenges people to engage differently in not just what's being said, but also this idea of memory work, connections to place, and the kinds of ways that we identify with Canberra. And for me, it was like really subtle things that I had overlooked because I'd spent so much time there. But it's like the color of the atmosphere of the light, like the particularities of that crisp light, because it's
really different.
Very crisp. Yeah.
Yeah.
Within the space, like the introduced trees, because Canberra was like this testing ground for introduced species. And so every suburb has like the inner suburbs have different trees that have been planted
there.
Yeah. So it's like a very planned city. And also just thinking about like, you know, there were things that I could identify, like the curve of a curb, you know, the eaves in a curb, the eaves of a house, like overlooked.
So interesting. But again, I think that, while it didn't make the PhD, I feel like it's all very related.
Yeah,
right?
It's about place. It's about connections. It's about vision, perception.
Yeah.
And I also showed, I was thinking, I was just going to, because they were only 8x10, I could only make that size prints with the hand process. But I was thinking about the idea. Because I was making work in reaction to this suite of works that were really that were praised at the time for being like really incredible work with color and printing and, you know, using a large format camera. And I was also trying to disrupt that a bit and like go, I guess, rebut some of that. And some of the text that was written about the work was like, you know, that it's so objective, this idea of objectivity. And I really thought that the interviews then could really create a lot of subjectivity that could then problematize this idea that continues through this capital P photography, you know, this straight photography. And I decided to show multiples because it's so process driven, the residency itself.
Yeah.
So I actually showed multiple different, like the one picture, but just the variations, because I would have to print like 5 to 8 to 10 pictures for every one picture that I liked. So under the glass on a table are the good ones, the goodies.
Yeah.
And then on the walls, kind of like flowing up in, you know, different amounts were the process ones. And so I kind of liked that. Then it's like nothing is really that objective when the color temperature can change.
Yeah.
You know, when all these things are so, there are so many variables in printing by hand color I don't know if I would do it again, but
I could. A very cool thing to learn.
Yeah.
All right. I'd love to finish with your manifesto.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Let me just find it. So it's a work in progress, obviously. It's my life's work. But in thinking about queerness and in relation to nature, I wrote something that I'd like to read out. Nature is queer and being queer feels natural. Queer is where my body meets the world. Queer is doing it differently. Queer is the connection to difference between bodies. These bodies can be bodies of water or masses of land. Queer is entwined, existing in space. Queer is the relational imbued in ecology. Queer is the twisting off course that what is not natural. Queer is twisting off a straight trajectory established by heteronormativity. Queer is not a sexual orientation decided by your sex. Queer is the abstract, the elusive, and the mercurial. Queer is the weird, the strange, and the solid. Queer is the dirt, the hurt, and the commune. Queer is the relational ties that draw people together through their differences. Queer is contextual. It exists in spaces over time. Queer is spatial. Queer is feeling differently. It was once thought to be queer was to be inverted. It was once believed that Australia was the inverse of Europe. The place where my body meets the world is stolen and unseated.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Pia. Cheers.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leidowitz.